First of all,
this is the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
It might be cool, I don't know. And if it's not, I don't care.
The BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Bill Simmons works for ESPN. He's also named the sports guy, and he writes a comical sports column. You must be a popular dude.
The BS Report.
It's got a real dirty sound, like a rusty steak knife cutting through a well-aged steak.
Now.
Here's Bill Simmons.
All right, welcome to the BS Report. We're coming up on a year of the BS Report. The anniversary is next week, and, you know, I just felt terrible. There's one guy that I didn't have on the first year we had on. There's really no reason for it. He should have been in the first batch of guests. We were able to work it out with his agents and his handlers and his managers, and now he's here as the final guest of the first year of the BS Report, the one, the only, Chris Connolly. Chris,
it's a pleasure to be your little red caboose, Bill.
I'm so sorry it took this long.
That's all right. I feel like Franklin Ajai or the late George Miller on the Letterman shows. You know, the guys who would always get on at about 15 seconds to 12:30. You know,
Feeling. Well, the thing with you is that I always knew we'd have a good podcast, and it was one of those things that there was no real urgency to do it because all the stuff we're going to talk about was going to be this timeless, non-urgent stuff.
Exactly.
And so here we are.
And actually, well, you've had a fantastic year. Congratulations on your
thank you.
First podcast year.
Oh yeah, it's been we've really turned the world upside down. But I want to have you on for two reasons. First of all, you let us do the fall mash of the Connolly pieces on ESPN we did for E60 with Rod Benson, which you loved. It's funny. Some people were like, was Connolly pissed? See, I was like, well, you don't understand Connolly. In fact, he would be delighted and enthralled.
Yeah, certainly. Certainly nothing concerns me more than the idea that people who actually watch my pieces believe that I am that same sober, solemn, grim guy in real life. So
the exact opposite. It's crazy.
Well, we're working on that. Yeah. And then the best reaction of all was from my wife, Gretchen, who, I gathered everybody around the TiVo to watch the beginning of your piece. And my wife, Gretchen, got laughing so hard at the beginning of it that she actually checked me to make sure that she wasn't laughing in an embarrassingly loud way.
Oh, interesting. You know, that kind of like marital tension.
That kind of laughter, like, and all of a sudden covering your mouth, like, am I insulting my husband by how hysterically funny I think this is?
That's funny.
So it was a big win in my home. Big win.
Well, the other reason we wanted to have you on, other than just to have you on, is we'll get to in a little bit. But I wanted to go through the history of Chris Connolly, because I think you've had one of the most interesting careers of anybody I know. Like, you've done all kinds of things that aren't related to each other in any way.
That's true.
And somehow you are where you are.
It's odd how you wind up getting to do these things when things haven't worked in a linear way. And as you know, particularly for people at ESPN, so many of them started there right out of college and came through the ranks and stuff. So it's fun to be in the mix with guys like that.
So you started at Rolling Stone.
When I got out of school, I taught school for a year, and then I answered an ad in the New York Times for the receptionist job at Rolling Stone.
And really? What year was that?
That was 1980. That was January 1980.
Okay, so you kind of missed the Coke years of Rolling Stone, unfortunately.
you know, everywhere I went, the first thing was always like, "Boy, you should have been here 5 years ago."
Right.
It was insane. I've always felt like the guy at the end of the fractured fairy tales, sweeping up behind the excitement.
Yeah,
but you remember how great the music of the '80s was, so at least I was around for that.
Well, you were there, so you were a receptionist, then you eventually started writing for them.
That's right. I my job was to sit on the switchboard and to answer the angry calls about subscriptions and to move calls along. And I think, as you know, whenever I got a subscription call I couldn't deal with and I couldn't get them to call the 800 number, I had to transfer the call to the new guy in subscriptions. And the new guy in subscriptions in 1980 is now John Skipper, the man who runs ESPN.
So wow.
You see what happens.
That's crazy. But you
always
good
be
thing,
nice to the new guy in subscriptions out there.
Yeah, I think we've all learned a lesson.
Well,
you may have missed the Coke years, but you were there for, in my opinion, the optimal time was right when they were filming Perfect.
That's absolutely right.
Which was the worst movie of the 1980s and one of the five worst movies ever made.
I'm going to point out that Perfect opened the Friday before the Sunday I got married. So if you can imagine the level of excitement, not only that, but Jan Wenner, the editor-in-chief of Rolling Stone, had recently purchased Us magazine, or as I like to refer to it, Chris Connolly, The Lost Years.
Right.
And I had been moved over, you know, fully in the belief that what America wanted was 2,500-word Morgan Fairchild profile. So I was working there, I was getting married, and Perfect was just getting into theaters. And the word was kind of getting out at, like, what kind of movie Perfect was going to be. And I, honest to God, remember going to the premiere on the Thursday before the Sunday I got married and thinking, not that bad. I think we dodged a bullet. So you can understand the delusion I was living
in. Wow.
Yeah.
Then no drugs involved.
You know, I was just high on, you know, I was high on lack of sleep, and I had my bachelor party on Wednesday, and at 10 in the morning the next day I was in there, you know,
right,
trying to make sure the Cher Q&A didn't go too long.
You didn't think the John Travolta, Jamie Lee Curtis sexual tension was sizzling, did you?
Let's not forget Anna Salvo. I thought Anna Salvo really heated it up in that one, too, so...
I had one of the ESPN bosses, Bob Wallace, who is one of the people in charge of creative development now.
Yeah.
He was like managing editor or something for Rolling Stone, and they used his office for the scene where John Travolta beats the hell out of the office with the baseball bat, which I think is a great claim to fame. Because it's one of the five worst movies ever, and it's one of the most memorable scenes in the movie, and it was your office. That's a nice way to go down.
And go figure, the next time Jan is on screen, he's in Jerry Maguire. You know,
albeit
for a briefer period of time, and he did great, you know, and the movie did great, so.
How has there not been a Jan Wenner oral history book yet? Because it seems like any person who has ever worked for him or dealt with him in any way has like seven stories.
Well, Robert Sam Anson, I think, wrote a book about, you know, the magazine writer most people are probably familiar with for his work in Vanity Fair. I think wrote a book about him, or a long magazine story. And then Robert Draper, who wrote for GQ and wrote for Texas Monthly, also did a big book. So,
which was excellent. That book is called, I have it right here, Rolling Stone Magazine by Robert Draper.
So
that's an excellent read. I agree.
He certainly got a lot of the stories in. So I'm sure there'll be more as time goes on. I have no doubt about that.
Oh, you don't think he's done yet?
There's been a big second act in the life, you know. I don't think people expected Us magazine to be the success that it became, you know.
Right.
And once they got me out of there, things really turned around. So
you went from Us to where?
To Premiere magazine, which was just getting started.
We talked about this last week, one of my favorite magazines, and just gone now.
Yeah, I know. It's a shame. I think it was difficult for it to succeed in the world where... You know, you can, I mean, back in the day when we were writing about a director getting replaced on a movie, a script that had gone into turnaround, somebody was coming in to do a rewrite, we were a monthly, and with a 6-week lead time, we'd still be the first people writing about that kind of stuff. And now, you know, you look at the internet and everybody's there, you know, everybody thinks grosses, everybody thinks process of movies. And also, this was just the age when the VCR was kicking in, when people were really beginning to examine movies the same way, when people were really working that freeze frame button on the love scene between Leah Thompson and Tom Cruise and All the Right Moves. And so there's a level of involvement in movies that I think people take for granted now.
And also maybe, well, I don't know if Entertainment Weekly is doing well either, but that kind of served a lot of the same purpose, but came out once a week.
Right. Well, they were the first challenge because all of a sudden, I mean, they may not have had exactly the same kind of obsessed audience we did, but exactly right. They were breaking this stuff on a weekly basis, but then they had the internet to deal with, and you know, now you just have to log on to, you know, any website and see the pictures, the updates, the guy getting fired, the crazy thing you used to have to wait a week or a month for. So, but I had a great time there. I had like the best time at Premiere, and Susan Lyne, who was the editor in chief most of the time I was there, was the greatest person in the universe to work with, and we had a lot of fun. And it's nice that people like you, you know, really seem to enjoy the magazine during our heyday.
I always judge magazines by how long I get out of them. Not whether my life has been altered in any way or whether I read something substantial, which is why, you know, Us Weekly, you say, or Us Magazine. Is it Us Weekly or Us Magazine?
I think it's Us Weekly now because it wasn't weekly when I was there. It was a bi-weekly.
Right.
You
say what you want about Us, but you'll get 25 minutes out of that if you're thumbing through it.
Well, sure.
You will look at all the pictures. You will. I don't care who you are. You'll look at every picture.
It's like highlights for children for adults.
Yes.
You know how they always had that thing where you had to compare the two pictures and what was missing in the fish tank in one and what was... It's the
right.
same thing with the pictures of Heidi now, you know?
Yeah, and they had the
who's
captions.
Who's wearing underwear, who's not wearing underwear, that kind of thing.
Stars, they're just like us.
They are just like us, yeah.
You have... You always get the three or four shots of the Olsen twins that make you wonder what happened and where the wheels came off and why they smile like two corpses. That's
always
fun.
You feel like the Olsen twins are like an evolutionary achievement up from Smurfs? You know, like they lost the blue color in evolutionary development, but like, you know, didn't exactly achieve the capacity for rational thought, and maybe the voices came down a little bit.
It's tragic what's happened to them. I mean, they really look like zombies now. I don't know if they have teeth. They never show their teeth anymore. It's just strange. Like, what, they're like these little 95-pound pixies that just wear these crazy outfits and... They just seem so sad and
they
morose.
Do seem a little, you know, they do seem a little, you know, sad. It would be nice to see some joy in them, you know.
Do but you
of
think
course,
anybody...
I think the key thing is for people like us to somehow drive a wedge of suspicion between the two of them.
That's the
Actually,
next step.
I just want to say, I didn't listen to anything Mary Kate just said about you. Mary Kate, I can't believe the stuff that Ashley is going around town saying about you, you know. Look what it's done for Lohan's career, you know?
I was going to ask, do you think it's possible for a child actor to turn out normal?
I think it's harder and harder now, you know? I think you still have the examples of people who, I mean, everybody has their eccentricities, but certainly someone like Jodie Foster seems to have made it through in good shape. Or,
right. You
know, someone like Brooke Shields, you know, as you know, has a great family and stuff, so... I think it's easier, obviously, when they have good, you know, this is a cliche, when they have good parents, but also advantage to the person on the TV show. Because, as you know, like, being on a TV show is more like a regular job than working on a movie or making a record. You have less free time. You got to show up in the morning. And I think the faux normalcy of that helps, you know.
But, whereas opposed if you're cursed and dunced.
Yeah, you have all this downtime, you know.
Yeah.
I remember interviewing Kirsten Dunst when she was doing Interview with a Vampire, and she had a younger brother who looked just like, you know, your old friend, Jonathan, what was his name? Lipnicki, remember?
Oh, yeah.
Jonathan
I love Lipnicki.
She, yeah.
J-Lip.
Her friend looked like a combination, her brother looked like a combination between Jonathan Lipnicki and the kid in A Christmas Story.
Mm-hmm.
And I just
Peter Billingsley.
Say, yeah, I just want to say, I hope it works out, man.
J-Lip.
Good luck to you. Don't be afraid to ask for a little attention because, you know, you deserve it.
Yeah, it's how long have you been out in Hollywood?
Since 1990.
Any
My
regrets?
Wife says it's the boyfriend in whose arms you don't want to die.
Yeah, rent. You're like the only person I know who rents because it's like you're still on vacation almost.
We could leave at a moment's notice, Bill.
Yeah,
you know,
I like that.
If the apocalypse comes, if that Reno earthquake shows up, we are, you know... We are so out of here. I showed up and we had the Rodney King verdict. We had fires. We had blackouts. We had, you know, riots. We had landslides. You know, earthquake, the Northridge earthquake. I had the full range of natural disaster in
so
the
you
first
were like,
4 or 5 years.
Well, it was like World According to Garp. After you saw the plane fly into the house, you knew it was safe to live there because it would never happen twice.
Exactly. It happens to Helen,
right.
as they say. So, so yeah, we oddly enough seem to have liked it, you know. I still get back
you.
To New York, where I'm from a fair amount, but it's all good. So,
all right,
and then
so,
all that time I was at Premiere, I started working at MTV. So I had those two jobs together for a long time.
And that's when you started red carpeting it.
That's pretty much true. Yeah, I hosted this show called The Big Picture, and then we would come out and do the Oscars and stuff. And so that's when I started getting the red carpet fibers on my pants, yeah.
Do you think you're the Michael Jordan of the red carpet or more like the James Worthy?
I think I'm more of myself as the Sideshow Bob of the red carpet.
Interesting.
You know, maybe the Mo Berg of the red carpet.
Is there a way to do it?
Is there a way to do it?
Yeah.
Well, it depends on the outlet, you know. I mean, the one thing about MTV was you were looking for a quick response, you know. Most of the red carpet stuff you see now is real time. It's like 40 seconds, 45 seconds.
You grab somebody, you pull them over,
right.
talk to them quick, they leave.
At MTV, you were just trying to get a reaction, so you'd interrupt people, you do all that stuff. The key... In terms of the Oscar stuff that I occasionally do now is, just like in baseball, give them a pitch to hit,
yep.
you know? Give them a question they can answer. And it's a thing people sometimes forget. They shout out an observation or they ask something, you know, about making the movie. And really, you just want to know, like, The appeal of the red carpet shows is that the one moment when these really poised, attractive people are as crazy, nervous, and scared as the rest of us are, you know, giving a PowerPoint presentation.
Yeah.
So what you want to do is somehow find a question that captures that, that humanizes them, you know. What was it like when you were getting ready? What does it feel like to hear people cheer, you know? But, yeah, give them a pitch they can hit, and then you're likely to get out of there with a W.
So you don't want to antagonize them in any way?
I don't think so, you know. I mean, I'm the guy who got spat at on the red carpet by Quentin Tarantino, so
really?
apparently I can do, you know, antagonism if you really want. But
why did that happen?
Well, it happened because he was under the misunderstanding that I had been the editor-in-chief of Premiere Magazine during the issue when the magazine ran a story about his biological father. I still haven't even read this story.
Yeah.
But I hope it was a great story. But he was under the impression that I had masterminded this. But in fact, I had resigned the editorship before that issue came out. And so 9 months later, as I tried to talk to him on the red carpet for MTV, he started pointing at me and making threatening gestures. It's all on YouTube. You can find the clip. It's pretty exciting.
I'm going to do it right after the interview.
One moment when it looks like he's going to punch me. And I have never been in a fist fight in my life. And I'm thinking, I'm going to get in a fist fight with Quentin Tarantino in front of 50,000 Dutch paparazzi on the red carpet at the Oscars. And then he goes back, you know, to throw the punch, and then he sort of goes, ah, oh, what the hell? And he spits at me instead.
Where did the spit land?
It did not land on me. His telemetry was poor. Clearly, he did not take trigonometry in high school, and it did not get on my tuxedo. And the next thing you know, there was the guy from Shine. So on we go. You know, it's like when you're walking through New York and, like, you know, a guy who lives on the street grabs at you or something, and you go by him, and you don't really think about it.
That was my encounter. Number one red carpet moment, probably.
That was right up there, yeah.
So
I mean, afterwards, people said, you know, once he finds out, you know, that you had nothing to do with that story, I'm sure he'll apologize. And I said, you know, you get spit at the red carpet, you don't really need a reason to get an apology.
Yeah.
But I'm still waiting.
What about number two?
Number two.
If it doesn't jump to mind, it doesn't count.
It may not. The one that jumps to mind was actually not mine. It was one where a colleague of mine interviewed Angelina Jolie and Billy Bob Thornton.
Oh, after they had sex.
Apparently, yes.
Yeah.
That's what they said. So
yeah.
Whenever you think of red carpet moments, that's the first one that comes to mind.
And now she has six kids. I think it's great.
I've momentarily lost track, but I think, well, she's got, what, she has four, and then people are saying that she's about to have twins.
Oh, yeah. So
I don't know for sure. So.
I don't think Brad Pitt's gotten enough credit for being the most whipped guy of this decade. this guy basically dumped Jennifer Aniston and started hooking up with this hot co-star, and now he has seven houses, six kids. He's flying all over the place. What's fun about his life?
She says he's a great dad. He teaches the kids how to ride the motorbikes. He's very physical with them. You know, he enjoys doing the tub time and all the rest of it, so... I hear he gets very high marks as a dad, and you and I have encountered Hollywood people in our time who maybe did not realize that they were 10 years older than they thought they were, and that they had responsibilities to be dads and husbands and stuff, you know, and so I actually think it's pretty cool that he's fulfilling his role so well.
Yeah, with a lot of the celebs, it's almost like they just got a dog from the pound when they have
exactly.
a kid.
No, I mean, I've been to things where people are going, and we are out till 6 a.m, and then we, and then, don't you have three kids in school?
Yeah.
Like, who's doing their homework? You know, who's helping out? That was really cool 10 years ago. But
the nanny business out here is probably one of the secret thriving businesses. Because why would you be a maid or a nanny in, like, you know, Baltimore when you could move out here and do
when
it
you
for
could rock
maybe,
it here? Yeah.
Yeah.
It's really amazing. Yeah.
Every nanny and every homeless person should move to California. No excuse. If you want to be a nanny or a homeless person, move here.
This is definitely the place to be a nanny. The money is, I guess, is pretty good. But, you know, you see, you know, like we never had a nanny, you know, my wife and I, we never had a nanny. We did it acoustic, but
I like that acoustic,
but I've seen nanny resumes, you know, and they drop big names on them, you know, there's, there's Bruce Willis, there's Eddie Murphy, you know, and you look at these, you look at these resumes and you start looking at them like they were the box office results. He goes, well, he hasn't hit in 10 years, you know. I wonder what kind of an Annie she is. That, you know,
Dave Cooley,
he can't get arrested in Hollywood now, like it's her fault.
Yeah,
amazing.
That's funny. All right, so. So you did the red carpet on MTV and Premiere. How did you end up with a talk show on ESPN, and what year was that?
Well, that was in 2001.
Oh, so you did the rest of the 90s. You did Premiere Magazine and red carpet.
I did Premiere until 96.
Okay.
And then I left Premiere in 96, and I did MTV all the way through 2001. And then I came over to ESPN to do Unscripted, which was a talk show that I have reason to believe you watched on occasion, Bill.
Did I watch it?
And there are a couple people that I know who also watched it, and that appears to have been about it.
I think I did see a couple.
I did a half hour with Jermaine O'Neal that got a number that, like, you know, it might have been the lowest number in the history of ESPN. Like,
got a reverse rating.
Yeah, you know that moment when Larry King says, "We'll be back with more," from Debbie Reynolds.
Yeah,
you know how you reach for, you know, how you're going to break your ankle to find the remote control to change the channel. I guess that's the effect Jermaine O'Neal had on the audience in 2001 or 2002.
He basically, it was like when he punched the guy in the Artest melee. He basically punched your show in the face.
He was perfectly nice. He was great. Yeah. It was like the audience, you know, the audience did not want to stick around. It got a .0. I mean, it was literally like, you know, if the rating had been his blood alcohol content, he would have been in no trouble whatsoever. So
yeah, I like that, the blood alcohol.
Yeah, the blood alcohol rating. He got a blood alcohol rating that would have allowed him to keep his license.
Yeah, that's,
you know,
good.
And go about his business. So that when they replaced my show with Around the Horn, you can look at like a year's worth of ESPN press releases, and they say, "We are up 75% in the afternoon. We are up 90%, and I would, you know, take credit for that. You know, I'd be like the nanny putting Bruce Willis on my resume, you know?
Well, in retrospect, that was, you know, I think TV had shifted to the point that nobody really wanted to watch a half-hour interview of an athlete anymore.
I think saying we'll be back with more from Jeremiah Trotter was just not the kind of thing that got people to stick around.
Yeah, they want quicker hits, 5-6 minutes with one guy, move to the next guy.
Yeah, I think real time with athletes is not where people, I mean, they're athletes, you know, you understand the difference. It's like, you know, people who are entertainers, you know, they're comfortable with the, you know, they like talking about themselves. That's part of their job. And it's a cliche, but it's true. You know, talking for an athlete is like passing the football was for Woody Hayes. Three things can happen and two of them are bad.
Right.
And so they, you know, they would rather not be interesting. Understandably, I guess.
If you had to do that show over again, Act One, you come out and you have a lot of crazy thoughts about a lot of topics for the next 4 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
Just make a lot of bold proclamations and say some crazy things. Then Act Two, you bring the athlete out. Act Three, you have four sports writers come on, they yell at each other. And then Act Four, you take an email and wrap it up, and that show works.
I couldn't agree more. I remember a character on SCTV that Dave Thomas did called Bill Needle. That's what I would be. I would be Bill Needle. You know, we did it in the ESPN zone with, like, really nice families during lunchtime from downtown Disney eating wings and stuff. And I would just get right in their faces if I had to do it. I'd just start screaming at them.
What are you thinking?
Yeah, so, you know, you're gutless. I think that's the word I would use, gutless.
So now
how gutless can you be? That kind of thing.
So now you're under contract, but they've canceled your show.
That's right. That's right. And so, of course, I wondered, like, you know, where would a bunny find a home, as we read to our kids, you know?
Yep.
Down the road. And you know who saved my career was Andre Bad Moon Rising. Because while I was still at Unscripted, sadly, Lisa Left Eye Lopez died.
Okay.
She died in the car accident in Central America, where, if you saw the excellent documentary, she was trying to find herself.
It was a very good documentary, actually.
It was a really good documentary. Yeah. It was really chilling. It was done by, you know, somebody I worked with at MTV named Lauren Lazen, who's very talented. So I got a call from Bristol, and they said, you know, Lisa Left Eye Lopez just died, and everybody remembers that she tried to burn down Andre Rison's house. And they were going out together. Could you write her an obit, you know, like a little piece about her that would work for SportsCenter, you know? And so I did. And it's funny, I'd done this show unscripted, but I just kind of did this little riff on Left Eye and Andre Rison and on the, you know, the bad history of entertainer-athlete hookups over the years, you know, mm-hmm. Lance Rensel and Joey Heatherton and Bob Waterfield and Jane Russell and Marcel Cerdan and Edith Piaf. And they ran it, you know, and I guess people liked it. And I guess somebody said, oh, you know, well, if we've got nothing we can do with him, maybe he can write a little. And I think that's how I got to do what I got to do eventually.
When did the shift happen where you just became the go-to guy for the sad pieces?
I think the shift happened when, wouldn't you know, we did a piece about a young man, a really poised, really intelligent young man from Winston-Salem, North Carolina, basketball player, whose grandfather had died, right after he had committed to his college and 2 days before a big game. And to honor his grandfather, he scored 1 point for every year of his grandfather's life, which was, you know, in the 60s. And,
yeah.
And when he scored like the 61st point, which was, you know, the year of his grandfather's life, he was fouled. And the team was way ahead, and he went to the foul line, and he tossed the ball to the referee, and he walked off the court. And the place went crazy. And that young high school man was Chris Paul. And
wow.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, just such a smart... He was taking AP Psychology, I remember. I said, why are you taking AP Psychology? He said, no, you got to understand, it helps me understand, like, as a point guard, helps me understand the guys on my team, like how they need the ball and how I can keep them happy. This is when he was a senior in high school.
So this is 2003?
This is, yeah, 2002,
yeah.
2003, yeah. You know, he was about to go to Wake Forest. You know,
right.
Everybody was thrilled he was staying at home. Great family, but we were talking before about what athletes are like when they speak about themselves. I don't think I've ever encountered an athlete, and this, again, he was in high school, who had the ability to very specifically talk about his feelings at three or four key moments, you know?
Mm.
Not in a generic way, but in like a really, you know, and so you just came away really impressed. I had no idea he was going to wind up being, you know, Chris Paul, the great basketball player. I don't have that eye.
Yeah.
But we did that story, and people really liked it, and it won an Emmy, I guess. And ever since then, I guess the audience seems to like these human interest stories, and we certainly enjoy getting to meet these people and telling their stories.
So you have a whole team?
I work with a large and exciting posse of feature unit producers, you know.
And since I don't
drive, I'm always riding with them in the front seat of the car, you know. So we get a lot of, you know, it's a very midnight run kind of situation with
gotcha.
me in the Charles Grodin role.
As the Duke. Nice.
Yeah, yeah. It's just like everybody movie. At some point I insist that we're driving up on something, you know, whether it's Sonic or whether it's a car accident, we just go, like that.
How many Emmys are you up to?
We're lucky enough to have 3, you know.
Where do you put them?
We put them, I keep asking the kids to take them and put them into their rooms, but we have them in the living room. My daughter likes to use the two wings on them for, to leave messages. You know, like a spike where you put a message on and stuff.
Yeah.
And when my daughter has her birthday party, she has an Oscar night party, she'll pick one up. And you know what she says when she pretends to give her acceptance speech? Wow, this is a lot heavier than I expected. So she knows the drill.
And you started doing stuff for 2022.
Yes, I did. Well, that was part of the deal when I came over to the Worldwide Leader in Sports. The guys, they were nice enough to get me a relationship with 2020. And I was also writing for Talk Magazine at the time, which was a Miramax thing, which was also owned by Disney. Now,
that actually should have worked, that magazine, and I don't know what happened.
Well, I'll tell you what happened.
Okay.
9/11.
Oh.
9/11 happened. And that just took the economy. I mean, the dot-com bubble ended, 9/11 happened, and that, you know, that meant it was pretty untenable for an unsupported general interest magazine, I think. And, you know, now, when I came to 20, Bill, you will probably realize or remember that you watch the Flintstones, right?
Of course.
You remember that Pebbles Flintstone is the biological child of Fred and Wilma Flintstone.
Yep.
But Bam Bam is not the biological child of Betty and Barney Rubble. Bam Bam was left in a basket outside the Rubble residence.
Because now, they couldn't conceive. They had Barney had impotent
problems. And they went through so much hell, you know, which is why Betty had those really like mood swings and the fluctuating weight gain. And also I think why Barney never, you know, grew past 5'3". So Bam Bam was left on the doorstep and they had no idea what to make of Bam Bam. So I was sort of the Bam Bam of 2020 for a while. I was this guy from MTV who'd been dropped on the doorstep, and I think initially they weren't quite sure what to make of me, but eventually we got to understand each other, and I've very much enjoyed my time with them ever since.
Do those news shows, are they doing well? It seems like they're not doing as well as they once did.
Well, you know, you have to just keep, you know, as you know, all of 2 through 13 television doesn't do as well as it used to, you know, which I think is part of the reason why you see these movies made from these, you know, unsuccessful or barely successful TV shows, you know. I mean, Get Smart, I Spy, those were successful TV shows, but not like huge. Get Smart was a hit show, but like there are things that are made that are not hugely overwhelming, but because there were so few options on TV, everybody knew about them.
Yeah.
So compared to those days with all the challenges, it's different. So you have to, you know, you have to respond nimbly to the desires of the audience. So
that's my theory on tennis and boxing.
How so?
More people cared about boxing and tennis back in the 70s and early 80s because we didn't have a lot of channels. So those things were on and you got sucked in. And somebody like me who loved boxing, I would have watched anyway. But a lot of people were casual watchers. And same for the Olympics and a lot of the stuff that was on just because there were no options. And now, once we got more channels, all of a sudden nobody watches tennis anymore.
I'll tell you what's really striking when you look at, you know, there was also the great superstar era there, too.
Yeah.
I'm the guy who once listened to a Wimbledon final on the radio, which is just an act of craziness. I listened to Bjorn Borg, Roscoe Tanner, the final at Wimbledon on the radio.
God. I didn't even know they had tennis on the radio.
They don't anymore. It was like deranged. It was like, is this how Ronald Reagan got started? But if you know, the other thing is, of course, and you know this, if you look at a paper like the Times or the Boston Globe or the LA Times from the 1960s, there is so much horse racing coverage, horse racing and track and field coverage from that era that would never get in now. Like, I remember growing up, I knew, like, you know, like the way, like, you think of in the 70s, you could list the 10 top heavyweights off the top of your head.
Yeah.
Like, back then, I knew, like, I could give you 10 racehorses, like, you know, just off the top of my head. Oh, yeah, there's Kelso, and there's Damascus, and there's Dr. Fager and all the rest of it. It's just a different world now, you know?
Well, even you look at Brady Bunch and Partridge Family, which were the two shows that were always on when I was in the mid-70s.
Right.
You know, as a little kid. We didn't have a lot of options. I liked those two shows, but I also, it wasn't like they were competing with 10 other shows, Nickelodeon, and all these different things that I would watch now.
No, you didn't have the Deadliest Catch over on the other thing. You had I'm Dickens, He's Fenster to watch on the other channel. So
when I was in college, and you bring up the three-part Hawaii episode, everybody on my hall would know what that episode was.
Yeah.
Whereas now, I don't know if kids had that same
And that's interesting you thing. Bring that up, because that's just as I was starting at MTV, was when Remote Control was getting started.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what they traded on, was this kind of collective memory of bad, you can't avoid it television. And it's also, and you've been around this too, you know what it's like when there's a hit at a network. You know how it transforms the people who are working on it, you know, how it changes, you know, it puts everything in a funhouse mirror. There are like 7 guys in Hollywood right now who got launched from the success of Remote Control. And it's a fascinating thing to be around at the time.
Well, and also, we talked about last week, both you and I like Reality Bites, which
is
one of the great what-ifs, or not what-ifs, great whatever happened to the writer who wrote Reality Bites. Her only IMDb.com credit.
That's right.
Never seen again. You always wanted to hunt her down and find her for a magazine feature or something.
I totally do. I mean, Helen Childress, you know, I can still remember her name. And, you know, when you were at Premiere, you'd read scripts, you know, and, you know, like, you know, like I knew what a good script was, but I remember reading that and going, this is so great. I can't wait to see this. This is so cool.
Yeah.
You know,
but that movie captured a lot of the way people interacted back then was through the pop culture experiences they had from watching, you know, there's a scene in there where they're just shouting out good times storylines.
That's right. That's right.
That doesn't happen now. It's just different era.
Well, I mean, it really was, it was the irresistible thing about the 90s, right? Which was, the ironic generation trying to be earnest. And so you think of the highlights of that idea, there's Reality Bites, there's, probably the second Nirvana album, and there's the Dave Eggers book, And those are like the holy trinity for me of the ironists, reaching for deep feeling. And that was just, that for me was the irresistible thing, in pop culture where you can see through all the defenses that people have, that whole generation had, and pop culture was the key defense, I'm ironic. I don't feel anything. Don't get near me.
I would argue Letterman started that because he was the first person I remember that really started tapping into that and started shaping that whole ironic sensibility that eventually took hold. Not to sound like too much of a
no, you're absolutely right. I mean,
intellectual snob.
But what's crazy? Like people don't realize maybe now how new that persona was. We take it for granted now. That's the mold that we think. But I was just reading something. When Johnny Carson was hired to host The Tonight Show, he was asked, straight-faced, when he was hired, what his favorite opera was. And he was expected to have an answer. And he did have an answer. These guys were supposed to be avatars of high culture. That was their thing. They were supposed to read books. They were supposed to go to the opera. They were supposed to go to ballet. Like, that's why we invited them into our living rooms in the 60s, So it's hard to remember, how revolutionary the Letterman persona was at night, and just how much more contemporary, as you say, it was, given, the irony generation.
Well, 20 years from now, they'll be saying the same thing about Jimmy Fallon.
Absolutely, yeah. Or magic.
No, with Jimmy Fallon, they'll be like, back in 2008, nobody knew that they should giggle through every interview. They just said it wasn't on the radar screen. And now we're all doing it. People are much less rounded. All right, let's get to
I think it will be the Mike Tyson pigeon piece that will really be marked as, turning point. Yeah. The pivot moment in popular culture.
Three big questions for you.
Sure.
Every time you're going to come on, we're going to ask you three questions. And you kind of tipped off the first one a little bit, but Reality Bites versus Singles. Is it really that clear for Reality Bites?
I think Singles was a really good movie. It maybe was a transitional movie for Cameron that way. It was more of a piece, I guess, but it doesn't stand out in his body of work, I think, to the degree the other ones do. I think he really loved that scene. And I think he loved some of those characters, but you'd say the cast maybe wasn't up to the casts that he had in other movies and stuff. So
what I'm saying, what is a more definitive 90s movie?
I think Reality Bites is a more definitive 90s movie. Remember, Reality Bites wasn't a big hit necessarily, but Reality Bites for what it did was more definitive because Cameron, I think by his own admission, would say his movie was part of what was going on in Seattle.
Yeah.
He wasn't so much finding something brand new as finding a way to express a certain type of personality. My feeling is always that Singles is the best drug movie of the 90s.
Oh.
And the drug is caffeine. Because Singles is about what happens when you've had too much caffeine. When you overthink every big decision in your life. Oh, well, maybe should I go over and say hi to her? No, I won't go over and say hi to her because that'll mean, so everybody in that movie is too jacked up. Not on anything illegal, but on caffeine. Like, they're thinking too hard. And it's only when that kind of wears away that actual connection takes place.
Interesting, Chris Connolly.
Thank you, Bill.
I actually disagree. I think Reality Bites was a really flawed film.
Uh-huh.
And the whole subplot with the guy, he might be gay, it's kind of like thrown in there for like one scene, and then it's never resolved. Like, I don't know. I thought Reality Bites was amateur hour in a lot of ways.
What we're not accounting for is my is my perpetual and eternal devotion to the goddess of the irony generation, Winona Ryder.
Right. Yeah, and really, yeah, I mean, you look at that movie now, and, like, she's not wearing a bra. She looks like she hasn't showered in about 2 months. And we were all attracted to her back then. I don't know how to explain it.
I wish the director had spared us that shot.
Yeah.
Of her going from the inside of the office building to the outside of the office building.
That's when she storms out after they show her the MTV thing, and she's walking, and her boobs are growing everywhere.
I thought that was unfair to the actress.
I have a personal bias against Reality Bites because the Ethan Hawke character was the kind of guy that I just hated in college, that I never got along with. I was natural enemies of the wild with. The kind of guy who, like, didn't like sports.
I didn't know guys like that into Holy Cross.
Oh, they did. They were everywhere, and especially after college. But the guys who always had, like, a paperback book of some really well-written novel from 1940.
Right.
And didn't work and begrudged everyone else who worked. And I just hated guys like that.
Well, it was, you know, but you would have to admit they were rife.
They were rife, and it was a great character in the respect that everybody knew at least one guy like Troy.
That's
the
true.
Guy that Ethan Hawke played. And also very nice use of U2.
Yeah, that was crushing.
What was it? I Want Is You?
Yeah, that still just makes you, you know, that it does get a little dusty, as you like to say, at that particular moment.
And I like the Garofalo HIV test Melrose Place. Oh, that whole scene was just really well done. Yeah.
You know, you almost don't remember that Janine was in that movie.
Yeah.
It's interesting.
All right, it's an interesting debate. Secondly, we talked about this at dinner, but we're going to recreate the debate and pretend that I asked you this out of the blue. Why hasn't there been a Fleetwood Mac movie? Because, in my opinion, that would be one of the all-time great flashback era movies, like almost Famous, but better because it actually happened.
Well, you know, I've thought about this since we initially discussed it, you know.
Yeah.
As I mentioned to you before, you know, it's the Stevie Nicks movie. The movie you have to make is the Stevie Nicks movie because she is the most compelling figure. The others were not stars the same sort of way. You know, they weren't like, if you showed somebody a picture of Christine McVie, they would need a while to figure out who it was. You know, same thing with Mick Fleetwood or John McVie. Even Lindsay Buckingham, you know, not a star in the way we think of people like, you know, Madonna or Michael Jackson or somebody like that.
Well, I told you my theory on that.
And that was?
I think his name killed him.
Lindsay Buckingham. His name.
It was a terrible name, and nobody knew if he was the British girl or the guy. Like, it was one of those ambiguous names. It's a hot girl name.
Well, and then her name was Stevie, so it could have been the guy, right? Right. So Stevie Nicks could have been the guy.
Or if he'd even been, like, Jack Buckingham. I think, like, if he had been Jack White, let's give him the name Jack White, the White Stripes guy.
He's
named Jack White. I think his whole career is different because he was actually really talented.
See, I had the same issue with the drummers in the Allman Brothers band. Like, it was the Reggie Cleveland issue. I knew they had two drummers. They had J-Mo Johnny Johansson, and they had Butch Trucks. And I didn't know which one was the Caucasian and which one was the African-American.
Yeah.
Could have gone either way, really.
Well, I was saying to you, I thought that there should be a movie made about from 75 to 77 mm-hmm. when they were putting rumors together and four of the five people in the band were dating.
We're all hooking
and they
up.
All broke up. They're all doing drugs. They're all hooking up with each other. And in the middle of this, they make this album that is probably the definitive album about breaking up with somebody else and all the bad blood and the skeletons.
They're great songs, amazing playing. I mean, you know, I mean, Mick Fleet, I mean, people just don't credit Mick Fleetwood with what a fantastic drummer he is and how distinctive he is. And I was of the opinion that, you know, that Lindsey Buckingham had never played a bad note, you know, just because it was always tasteful and well done. So I completely agree on the quality of the record. The other thing I would say, though, is that the hookups were weirdly not inconsequential, but, like, nobody threw themselves off a mountain for it, you know. They were like, you know, they all seemed to take place in a kind of drug fueled haze, you know.
Right.
But the band stayed together and nobody slashed their wrists and nobody did an overdose of drugs and had to go to the hospital or try to kill themselves. I mean, as bad as it got, it in a weird way was, you know, there was a kind of anemy, maybe drug induced anemy, that sort of settled over it all, you know, that meant it wasn't like, you know, it didn't have consequence. Like, nobody left screaming out of the band and, like, boy, you wish what would happen then. So maybe that was the problem. There's no third act on it.
See, I would argue that there was a third act because, and Diablo Cody was the first one to point this out on Entertainment Weekly, but she talked about this YouTube clip from the 97 tour when Stevie Nicks sings Silver Springs, which was left off the Rumors album, which was
right.
Ridiculous. And it's a whole song about how Lindsey Buckingham broke her heart and she's always going to haunt him and he's going to hear her voice. And every time she hears it, every time he hears it, it's going to haunt him. So she sings this song to him in this 97 concert. And this is, they'd been broken up for 20 years.
Right.
And she gets into it in the last third and that crazy look comes in and she's just belting it out and screaming, my voice is going to haunt you or whatever the lyrics are. And he's just playing the guitar with the deer in the headlights look like. You know, he looks like Steve Nash at the end of last night's Spurs game. Just kind of like, hey, can we end this? And it's just like this great moment. And I was thinking, like, what other musical band would have that kind of history that 20 years later, you know, would still have this raw emotional moment that would come out on stage like that? It was just fantastic.
Well, you know, it's what people always loved about her is that she had deep feeling, you know. She meant it. I mean, as did Christine McVie. There's songs on, you know, they don't have the unique sort of, you know,
right.
Rhiannon and bewitching quality of Stevie's work, but there is naked emotion in her voice too, you know.
So you don't think Scarlett Johansson is Stevie Nicks? That doesn't work for you.
Oh God, no, not yet. Anyway, we're just seeing if we can get through the Tom Waits record, don't you think?
All right.
You know, if I could have thrown, it's like watching a kid cross the street in front of a school and a bus comes by. If I could have thrown myself in front of Scarlett Johansson, you know, and doing a Tom Waits record, I would have done it, you know. I don't see how it works out to anybody's benefit.
They all think they can do more than what they're doing.
Well, you know, and they all can. It's just that, like, this is, I mean, I don't know what letter to do it, but I guess it's all those people going, wow, you sound great, you know. You sound great. Wow, that just sounds great, you know. And because you can, you know, because people will be ready to make money off it, next thing you know, there's 12 Tom Waits songs on a CD with your picture on it.
All right, let's go to the third topic, which is
sure.
The most relevant because the Suns were just killed yesterday. And I'm actually going to write about this, and I'm going to give you full credit.
Well, you're very kind.
Your concept about critically acclaimed sports teams,
that's
which
right.
I loved, and I actually thought about just stabbing you in the heart at dinner. So I could take the theory, and then people would be like, wasn't that no, I don't know what you're talking about.
I don't have, you know, people get so hung up on plagiarism these days and borrowing, and I really don't care. It's like if somebody tells a good joke, you want somebody to tell everywhere, you know? Credit is baloney, you know?
I'm the opposite. I'm an only child. I love coming up with my own stuff, and I hate when somebody else comes up with something that I felt like I should have come up with.
Well, that's the way, and you get ripped off a lot, so you have understandable feelings that way. So,
but this was brilliant.
If you like it, I'm honored. That's great. I think that's
this was great. So, explain the critically acclaimed sports teams.
When I came over from entertainment to do sports interviewing, people said, "What's the difference?" And I said, "One of the nice things about it is there are one-loss records in sports." You know, it's like you win 13 games, you lose 26, you know, you stunk, you know. You didn't have a critically acclaimed 3-13 season.
Yep.
Because when you interview entertainers, it's like, well, nobody bought your record, but it was a cult classic. It was a critically acclaimed record, you know, that kind of thing. So I liked that. But then I got to thinking, well, what about teams that didn't win championships but really were beloved and to some degree more fondly remembered than the teams that actually did win championships that year? What if there were critically acclaimed sports teams? So it seemed like a useful concept.
I love it. And the example you mentioned first, which I just thought was the perfect one, was the Air Coryell Chargers.
Exactly. You know?
Because I feel like they won the Super Bowl, and yet they didn't even play in the Super Bowl. But I remember them over any other team from that era.
The Kellen Winslow game, all those fantastic Monday Night Football games. And honestly, you can't remember the game they lost to the Bengals, right? Like, you can't even remember it. They opened the doors so that the wind was really bad and Fouts could. I can't remember that game.
Yeah.
I remember those incredible games, that incredible game with the Dolphins, those shootouts on Monday Night Football. They typified that era for me, you know? Fouts and Chuck Muncy and, you know, all those fantastic wide receivers and Winslow, of course. So, you know, I think of that era, they're my team. So,
a couple others that you mentioned, the 75 Red Sox.
Right, that's
definitely.
Right.
Definitely.
Well, and that's a class. I mean, that's obviously, you know, that's obviously a, you know, kind of an example of it. Like apparently the Reds actually won that series, but
right.
Who would know from the millions of trees that have been, you know, that have been felled in order to talk about Fred Lynn and, you know, all those guys on that team.
Yeah, the Reds won the war. The Red Sox won the battle, but the battle became bigger than the war.
Yeah, it became the iconic, you know.
Yeah.
You know, that made everybody a lot of money. But so also, then, that's the team that everybody will always love, so.
Then you have Rocket Ismail, the Notre Dame teams.
Yeah, you know, I always used to refer to that call in the, what was it, the Orange Bowl as the paper clip, you know.
Right.
On that run back, it's like, you know, it's like any Hollywood producer would have, like, taken the referee out and, you know, done what happens at the beginning of The Last Boy Scout to him.
Right.
You know, we're just going to deal with this. He's going to score the touchdown. And everybody's going to go home happy. But that's what you remember is that fantastic, you know, that fantastic run back at the end of a fantastic season.
Then a couple more late 40s Dodgers. 1974
right.
Holland World Cup team. I'm not even going to go there.
That's my all. Oh, that was a total soccer team. That was Johan Cruyff and all those great players. They were undone. In the final, I mean, they were like the soccer team of the 70s, and I love them because, and you'll appreciate this because this was the same era as the Big Red Machine, they were the first elite athletes I ever saw who looked like the rock stars that I liked. They
yeah.
all had long hair, they were all thin, you know, they all looked like guys, and they all looked like the faces, you know, like guys in British bands. They lost the final because they scored the first goal almost by mistake. There was a penalty call in the first minute of the game, and they had to play with a lead, and they never played with a lead before, so they lost to Germany. Holland losing to Germany. Has that ever happened before?
I thought they lost because of the bong fire in somebody's hotel room the night before. 1974 Holland? Come on.
No, that's the Stanley Wilson story.
They must have had a ton of
pies. That's the least covered story in sports history, the Stanley
oh, you're
Wilson
right.
story.
It's a good point.
That's
you know, one team you left off your list that you sent me was the Fab Five.
Oh, the Fab Five. Oh,
yeah.
Right.
The Fab
That's
Five have
right.
to be on there.
That's absolutely right. The Fab Five, they totally belong there. That was like you leaving off Suns Lakers off your last list.
Yeah.
Absolutely right.
Yeah.
Fab Five are a classic example of that, you know.
Yeah, and in fact, I think people now think that the Fab Five actually won one of the titles that year.
I think they do. I really
yeah.
do think. Because, you know, it was hard to remember, you know, because, you know, you have to remember Houston never won and the Fab Five never won,
yeah.
right?
Yeah,
but
Houston
like,
was another one. Five Slam a Jam, I think,
right.
critically acclaimed.
That's true. That's certainly true also. But like, there's that year that Georgetown did win after the 2 years that Georgetown didn't win.
Yeah.
And there was a year Michigan did win, but it wasn't the FEP. So that maybe is why it's hard to remember. But that's absolutely true. You know?
Would you call the four straight Buffalo Bills Super Bowl losses, would you call that a critically acclaimed team?
No, I wouldn't, because I didn't think they were beloved that well.
Yeah.
I didn't think America kind of responded to that, because I thought about them. And no, I don't think so, you know. I always liked Marv Levy, but I don't think they really, you know. I think people were embarrassed every time they showed up. They were like the relative with the drinking problem that always comes to the wedding reception. It's like, oh my God, they're back. Can you believe they're back, you know?
Weber's
even
Kings.
Even the call, you know what the other thing, you know, you talked about how some calls of great football moments are flawed.
Yeah.
You know, the greatest flawed call in football history is the comeback. You know, is the radio call from Buffalo of that comeback against the Oilers. It
yeah.
should have been the greatest radio call of all time, and it's not that good.
Hmm.
Just going to tell you that much.
Another one I thought of, Jimmy Connors, his last U.S. Open comeback.
That's true.
Now, when he lost in the semis.
Now, he'd been a champion, so, and he
yeah.
was, and he was a despised champion. Like, I remember when Arthur Ashe beat him at Wimbledon. That was a big, fat deal.
Yeah.
When Arthur Ashe took the young punk down. You know, so I would say, you know, I know what you mean. Like, I can still see that shot and, you know, the pumping and all the rest of it.
It was a critically acclaimed comeback.
Right, that's true. That's true. You know, the return of a champion that way, yes.
But and the other two you have that just cracked me up, and I'm not even to ask you to elaborate, but you have the figure skater, John Misha Pekovic. And Annie Duke, the poker player.
Pardon me? Annie Duke, yeah.
Annie Duke, the poker player.
That was kind of for you, Annie Duke, the poker player, just because I figured I should throw a card. John Misha Pekovic, this is the old days. You asked me not to elaborate.
No, nobody wants to hear you elaborate.
I'm sure.
Was there an Olympian who was critically acclaimed though?
He didn't, you know. I'm sure there was, like, some guy who came in second, and what an incredible achievement that was.
Yeah,
probably not. The 1972 basketball team.
Oh, yeah, I guess that would be the best.
Doug Collins, the 1972 basketball team. Because, you appreciate this, of course, but those are the, even though his team wound up losing, those might be the two greatest free throws.
Yes.
In the history of basketball.
I agree. I have them ranked one. And number two, I'm gonna say Rolando Blackman in the 1987 All-Star game.
Oh, okay.
Not the same stakes, obviously, but to have all the greatest guys in the court and you're already middle of the greatest All-Star game ever and you have Isaiah Thomas trash-talking you as Magic's pulling you away. No time on the buzzer and you hit two free throws.
That's pretty good. Yeah, we need to give, attention to these. I don't think Collins' free throws even hit the rim. They just dropped right through, and I.
Well, also, he got nailed on that play. Yeah, the game was delayed for, 5 minutes while they, scraped him off the basket support, and then he ended up shooting those. Yeah, that was terrible. They can't make enough specials about that game, in my opinion. Every 3 years, there should be another special about that. How terrible that was. All right, we got to go.
There's really nothing like it, isn't there? There is nothing. That guy running down from the, it's incredible. It's just, I still remember Frank, Alexander Belov.
Who was 45 years old, too, which is the other great thing.
Sure, he made Arvydas Sabonis look like, Kenny the Jet in his prime, yeah.
All right, we got to go. We're going to have you back.
Bill, thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
I loved having you on. We're going to come back. I'll think of three more questions. Try to really sort out that Stevie Nicks movie for me for the next
time. I'll do what I can. We'll cast it, and then we'll figure out the guys around her, yeah.
All right. And and I actually don't regret not killing you after you told me the critically acclaimed thing, because I'm glad we had you on.
Talk to you soon.
All right. Take care.
You too. Bye-bye.
Target to sign off. Whoa.
Thank you for downloading the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Too much fun.
Check out more podcasts at the iTunes Music Store or at PodCenter at ESPNRadio.com.
Peace out.